All right. Hi. My name is Alex Turner. I am the program manager for the VB and C Sharp compilers, Microsoft. And I'm here today to talk about Project Roslyn, specifically this effort we have going on to rewrite the managed compilers, the compilers for the C Sharp and VB languages in managed code. And in doing so, to expose the core code analysis engine to a much wider audience. Really, at this point, when you guys go through this talk, I'm hoping that you come away with these three particular things. I mean, most core of all, being able to explain really what the purpose, the scope, and the core goals are of Project Roslyn. Like, why we're going about this. Like, after 10 years, why are we bothering to rewrite the compilers and not just sticking with what we've got, right? And also that you can start to get a sense for how you can start to use the tools we're giving out, things in the Roslyn CTP, the APIs we're exposing, to start building this kind of rich code-aware tool that we really see being the future within the IDE, and specifically around VS extensions. And then, you know, being able to actually specifically talk about the API, right? We're going to go over the API layering, how we're actually designing these Roslyn APIs. This is something that you guys can play with, and we want your feedback, but we're just trying to talk now about how we see things and start this conversation going. So, I mean, the first question is really, what is Roslyn? And you may have heard us talk about this. You've probably heard talks where we've talked about async and other language features and kind of mentioned Roslyn. You may have heard us talk about this as compiler as a service. Anders started mentioning that in his talks back in, 2008, I believe, at PDC, we were already talking about this. And it's really this idea of opening up the black box that is the compilers, or the compilers we have today. Think of what a compiler does, right? Takes in source code and takes in some set of references. And then it does a whole lot of detailed analysis on that code, right? It's going to take all your references, pull them into a symbol table, all the things you define, come up and bind all this data, figure it out. What are you actually trying to, to build these classes, these namespaces? It figures all this out, and then it just kind of dumps out a binary, right? And it takes all this data and it throws it away, except for the final output that it has. That's a lot of rich data. That's the kind of data that, for example, the IDE currently uses, right? We take our native compilers and we build them, and those same bits become the IDE language service that powers IntelliSense, that powers refactorings, right? And so we're able to look at a lot of this data internally within the Visual Studio team. But if you guys want to go write some refactoring, you want to write some code-aware tool, you basically have to start from scratch today. You look at things out there in the industry, things like ReSharper, right? There's successful products that are out there, but look what they have to do. They basically have to re-implement an entire C-sharp or VB analysis engine from scratch just to get off the ground floor. And once they've done all of that work, now they can begin to think about like the very first refactoring they're going to offer, or the very first IntelliSense replacement, and start to get back to parity so they can do that one extra thing. And so we're really about how can we make this a far more incremental process where anybody who wants to add value can just do that little bit of value they want to do and across the board. And so at the core, what this really comes down to is this idea of having these managed compilers that are actually exposed, opening that black box and making the data available to everyone. So it comes out of the managed compilers, comes out of managed language services. So we're rewriting the C-sharp compiler in C-sharp and the VB compiler in VB. And these will become the core of these new APIs that were being exposed by Project Roslyn. And these are code analysis APIs, right? So these are APIs that let you introspect deeply into what code is doing. What do the trees look like that actually break down the code when you parse it? What are things binding to? If I was to put some token here, would it map to this local or would it map to this static, right? How do you answer those kind of questions knowing the entirety of the language semantics? And it also represents scripting APIs. So there's many cases where you want to take some sort of snippet of code and you want to evaluate that in some context. Imagine that you're some host that has some values and you want to expose these, let's say, as globals and let people provide expressions to you. And you want them to be able to provide expressions in C-sharp and then go ahead and parse that in some context that you establish. You know, today you can kind of fake these things up and kind of make an environment that some whole C-sharp fake project and kind of build it. But you have to jump through a lot of hoops, right? We're not making that easy at all. And so as part of what Roslyn, what we're doing here is trying to provide these kind of scripting APIs that, again, let you have this very piecemeal way of buying into evaluating code. And we talk about language service extensibility here. You know, it's all well and good for us to give you access to this data, but if we didn't let you hook into the IDE in the same way that we do, you know, you'd still have to write your own replacement for everything we're doing just to get back to parity. So we're really trying to take all those places, adding things to IntelliSense lists, adding things to smart tags so you can add your own refactoring, so you can add your own quick fixes, those kind of things. We want to make all those extensibility points really smooth and really easy to use so that you guys have just as much power as we do and it can all participate together. And then you start to think of things like redeval print loops. Once you have this rich iteration you can do, well, think of things like F-sharp interactive, right? Like you have this more chatty interaction with the F-sharp compiler. I can give it an expression. It gives data back. I feel like I'm operating and building types and the methods on those types in this interactive environment. Whereas C-sharp and VB feel like they have this sort of build it, you know, deploy it, see what it does. You can poke at it, and if you want to change it, go build something else, right? And you want to get to that sort of more dynamic world. And that, you know, dynamic in the way of being able to modify it, right? And it turns out, you imagine Python and Ruby and these kind of environments that often have these interactive environments, but it's not really tied to the fact that they're dynamic languages, and F-sharp is good evidence of that. So we want to bring that experience over to VB and C-sharp. So we've kind of been talking about ROS and this kind of stuff for a while. It's getting more real now, and you'll get to see that. But the, you know, big question people always ask is, all right, when does this actually come out? So we like to say now that the ship date is vNext plus N, where N is greater than 0. And this is vNext being Visual Studio 11, right? So if you get Visual Studio 11, there's a lot of cool stuff you can play with. Roslyn is not going to be something that ships as like an RTM release, and Visual Studio 11 will likely just have some CTP that targets that. And it's something that we're still looking into, like where does it actually fit into our release cadence? Where does it fit in terms of when we can start integrating it with different components? We're still looking into that. For now, this is more of a science project, and we're still trying to get this up and running. What you can get today, we do have a CTP that's publicly available, and it lets you go and you can poke with a lot of these extensibility points. You can start to make quick fixes. You can make these refactorings. But even still, even the core language semantics are still being fleshed out. There's language features that we haven't gotten to yet. So, you know, just so we can actually get on the same page before we dig too much into the details of what Roslyn is, let's just do something quickly and to get a taste for what it makes possible. So what you're looking at here, this looks kind of just like Visual Studio 2010, and it is, but what you notice up here is that the tab that I'm on with program.cs, this has this Roslyn on it in brackets. And what that means is that I have the Roslyn language services loaded now. If I go here to the extension manager, I can see that I'm using these replacement language services. And, you know, it's doing some things, like it's providing these sort of line or procedure separators, even though I'm in C-sharp and not VB. We're kind of exploring what features to pull from one language into the other here. But, you know, generally, things are working the same. We've got colorization up and running. We have outlining up and running. But we can also start to do some more stuff now that we have this really new data that we're starting to pull together. So we have here, okay, so I have basically a simple thing. It's just calculating some area by doing, you know, pi r squared and printing it out. But I see I'm using 4.0 twice. And so if I actually select 4.0, you notice I'm getting a smart tag underneath. And if I pull up something for that smart tag, you see I'm getting different options. And one of them is introduce local for 4.0 or introduce for all occurrences. So I'm going to choose introduce for all occurrences. And you see, like, now I've pulled this out. And I can start to say, all right, well, maybe I'll name this. And you notice I'm getting this kind of manual rename or inline rename here. And it's telling me, hey, you're going to be renaming these three things as part of this refactoring. And I can just kind of commit the refactoring here. And I didn't have to go to some other window to do that. I can get this rich dynamic interaction with the working tree. And then I can say, all right, well, maybe I'm going to go pull this apart and say this should go be its own method at this point. So I go here and I say extract method. And I'm getting a preview of what that's going to look like, what the future will look like if I execute that refactoring. And when I hit this, you see, all right, it generated this. And it even came up with an intelligent name for the method I'm making because it saw that I was assigning it to a variable named circle area. So it said, hey, maybe this is something called get circle area. you know, and it's able to dig into the tree where I'm applying it to. So, you know, these are things that become very easy to do once you're exposing all this data in this very regular way. And the idea is that, you know, we could have potentially pulled this kind of stuff off ourselves with this whole native model we provided, but now this is just as easy for you guys to do as it would be for us. So this is the kind of thing we want to make super smooth and super streamlined. So if we think about what Roslyn is, right, that was sort of what Roslyn is meant to enable, but what Roslyn is, it really is at its core this reimplementation of our compiler pipeline. And if you think of the stuff that any old compiler is going to have to do, well, it's going to have to go through these kind of phases, even just to get, you know, a binary out the other end, right? You're going to have to start off parsing source code. Someone's going to give you source code. You need a parser that's going to take that and turn it into syntax nodes for your particular language. So in this case, we're going to have one of these for C# and one of these for VB and parsing those languages. And so on top of that, there's going to be some specific representation we have for C# and VB syntax nodes, and that's going to be a core API that we see later. After that, we have the symbol table. You need somewhere as you're parsing this and you're getting, hey, there's some class called C and there's some method called M. We start aggregating this data together in the symbol table. And this becomes the source of truth for names, and it's there alongside other names that we get, names that we import from metadata. So we get names from two sources, your source code and the assemblies that you reference. And so we pull all that together, and then, you know, once we have trees and we have some references and names, we then go about binding, right? So the tree tells us you're calling something called foo, but, you know, maybe foo is a method that has three overloads. And the way we figure out which overload you're actually meaning to call is based on the types of the parameters that are being passed, the arguments being passed to foo. And the way we even know what those types are is by actually digging in and seeing what members those things are, what objects those things come from. And so we sort of plumb all that data through the rich type information, and we apply all the semantics of the language. We kind of have the binder here as the biggest box, because that's really where the meat of the language comes into play, all the overload resolution rules and the, you know, idiosyncrasies of the conversions that language enables, all the things that make that one language different than another. And then on the other end, we got the IO emitter, right? After we have all this stuff, we figure out exactly what we want to do. We have to go actually spit out the binary, right? And you could spit it out to a file or to a stream and imagine doing different things with that binary when you're done with it. And so again, we have all these kind of things, and they're all unique to the particular languages because the languages are different enough that you really don't want to be abstracting over them at this kind of low layer. There's been different projects at Microsoft and elsewhere in the industry at different times. You want to kind of come up with this one tree to rule them all, right? And hey, maybe we can have this, you know, one meta language and everything goes to that language and out. And you know, you can do those kind of things for certain academic purposes. What we find is if you actually want to make this kind of full fidelity round-tripping environment where you can interact with source code, going to any of these kind of reductive representations really burns you on the way back. And it really doesn't let you have that interaction, doesn't let you write refactorings that are very high quality. And so we're keeping these kind of separate APIs at that level. So the layer where they actually unify, the layer where you start to bring C# and VB together and say, all right, I'm going to have one common API and way that I can deal with both of them, that's at this next kind of layer here. The layer beyond that. And compiler APIs here, basically, you think of this, I'm surfacing up from the parser, I'm surfacing up the syntax tree API, right? From the symbols, I'm surfacing up a symbol API, from the binders and so on. And, you know, this is this idea that each of the languages is going to actually go and expose these APIs out to the world. And if we think what we can build on top of that, right, you look at all the services that the IDEs have today, things like formatting, things like IntelliSense, where you hit dot, what things are available, what methods are available on some type. You know, when I'm formatting my code, I need to know what things are. I need to know this is a lambda expression. I need to know what type this resolves to so I know how to deal with all the stuff that I have in my editor. And so, you know, we see how each of these map, you know, the symbol API, if I want to navigate to, I need to remember where something was defined. So if you hit F12, I can jump to where that definition was. If you have extract method, I need to know things about how the data is flowing around that code, like what variables are expected to be defined by the snippet that I try to extract out so those things can become parameters. I need this advanced data flow analysis. So I need to be able to do all these things, and to do so, I need access to this rich data that's at the underlying layer. So that previous slide, that is kind of what we've shown before, right? That represents really at this low level, the sort of low-level language-specific APIs. So actually, this is the slide where we start to decide how things pull together, right? We start to talk about how C# and VB end up combining. And you can kind of think of that whole last slide and the way that you could build up to these high-level things as being really now into this bottom tier, right? You know, the C# and VB teams, even at Microsoft, used to be separate teams, and they each kind of built their own silos, right? Since then, we've combined, and this is the first time we're actually starting to leverage that ability that we're combined at the sort of core architecture of what we're designing. And so, you know, you take these things at the bottom layer that are language specific, and you also add on this scripting API, the one that we want to add, lets you kind of dig in there and evaluate little snippets of source code. And then you start to build this services layer on top of it. And this services layer, you start to get this idea of sort of these projects that you can build on top of your source code. Things like, like a REPL, right, for example, something where you can pull in different data from different places and have it all live in an environment you can explore, or something more traditional, like the projects and the solutions that you're used to inside the IDE. And the Workspace API is really what we expose that lets you dig down into that, lets you form these projects and form these solutions. And these solutions can have some projects which have VB code and some projects which have C# code, and those projects can start to relate to each other. And, you know, again, the symbol table in one is going to be very different than the other, but there's still this core idea of what a symbol is, right? And as you start to unify these, you can imagine saying find all references and have it go into your VB project and into your C# project and know that this token foo is used here and it's also used there. So it knows enough about what's in common while still sort of honoring that difference between the languages. We'll see some how that works. And so once you now have this common representation, some of these shared things, you can start to build these services. So you can build find all references. You can build code formatting. You know, you're still going to have language-specific rules for doing code formatting, but you can provide a common service that lets you format a document, and it'll just figure out what kind of language it is and ask that language to go help out as it's formatting. You can do name simplification and ensure that as, you know, relating to the semantics of the language, how do I shorten these names so I don't have to actually say the entirety of, you know, the namespace? How do I shrink that down when I'm generating code so I don't generate code the user wouldn't have written themselves? And then so if you think of the sort of core, you know, language-specific compiler layer and then the unifying services layer, this top layer is really where you start to interact with the IDE. So now we have this layer where we're talking to Visual Studio. So we're doing things like code actions, like the smart tags that show up in the IDE, things like classification so we can colorize your code, completion so we can give you IntelliSense. These are things where we actually interact with the specifics of VS as a shell. And you can imagine some sort of other shell, maybe some other editor. You'd have some other interactive environment that presents some unique view over your code, and it would offer its own services. But these are really the services we think of when we're thinking, how do we build out a core sort of code-focused IDE that you want to be able to operate in and do all this rich stuff with? And so those kind of things, those top-level things on the previous slide, that's like the quick fixes that we saw. And as we get towards the end of this talk, you'll see how we can actually build some of those things ourselves. So the core of all this, though, like you get back down to that low level, you have to have some way that you can describe code. And you have to have some way that you can talk about it that all the different APIs that we're talking about here can, you know, interop with, that they can hand around this common representation. And syntax trees are really that currency. It's the core representation of either C# or VB code that everybody understands across the board. And because it's so important, and actually because it has to serve so many different purposes, imagine the different cross purposes. One is batch compile. I want to give you source code and you spit out a binary as fast as possible. Another one is interactivity. I want to be able to type my code in the editor and have you constantly be reformulating these syntax trees as my code is changing in real time. And these are sort of pretty divergent goals. And we really need to come up with one representation that is able to serve both of these needs. So some of the principles we think about when we talk about how we have to design syntax trees, some of them might be a little bit unexpected if you've thought about this kind of stuff before. One of them, and the first one, really is maybe the most unexpected, in that the syntax tree API that we have, the nodes themselves are immutable. And they're immutable in the way that strings are immutable. You know, you can concatenate strings together, but when you do so, you get a different string object. And so you're always modifying the pointers that you're holding to things, but the objects themselves out in the world stay the same once they're created. And it's the same way for our syntax nodes. Once you create a representation of a method and it has particular children, you could hand that method off to somebody else, and that represents a snapshot of the world at that point in time. And you mutate the world simply by creating different snapshots, and we'll see a concrete example of that in a bit. But the benefit of having this snapshot model is that you can hand these things off and actually do this background processing without having to worry about your world changing out from under you. Imagine a world where somebody's typing into the document and they're constantly changing it, but you want to run some analysis that might take 5 seconds to search for, you know, duplicate code, like the kind of code clone stuff that you've seen. Well, if I'm doing that, I don't want to be analyzing this code and have half the method change while I'm halfway done analyzing it. I want to have a coherent view of the world, even if it's a few seconds old. And so these immutable snapshots give us that ability. It's also important that these syntax trees be complete. We need to be able to represent everything in the source code. We need to be able to represent comments. We need to be able to represent white space and all of those kind of things, things you usually throw away in syntax trees. We need this because when you perform a refactoring, if the refactoring is going to be a transform on top of this tree, we don't want to lose all of that rich information. Nobody would use your refactorings if it was, you know, semantically equivalent but threw away all your comments. So we need to have that in the tree, and we have an interesting solution for handling that. Sure.
What about incorrect?
That's actually the next one. So when we talk about resiliency in this case means resiliency to errors. Like when you have a tree that has to represent not just like batch compile, but also interactive typing scenarios, as you're typing a new line of code, 99% of the time the code is an error until you type like the last semicolon. You know, and especially think every time you hit dot and you want IntelliSense to appear, you know, you haven't typed the next token yet. So when you hit dot, your code is always in error state. And so we have to be able to deal with that and say, all right, well, you wrote dot there. You probably are going to have some sort of token. Let's put this error token there that represents what it is and assume you're going to kind of close it off with a semicolon and then treat the rest of the lines as being coherent. And you notice that, you know, when you're writing one line of code, everything after that in your file doesn't become invalid even today, right? And it's actually pretty non-trivial to get that kind of error tolerance to work when you're making syntax trees, and people can make any arbitrary edits in your file, and you need that to be really performant. But that is a core component, and we need to represent that in syntax trees. And the other thing is that, yeah, all this stuff has to be efficient, right? It's great to say we want immutable snapshots, but if every time you did anything, it like copied your entire tree and duplicated it every time you had a keystroke, that wouldn't work out. So we need to have these snapshots, but we need to be able to architect them in a way that every incremental change is not totally ballooning the size of the stuff that you have to do, either for the memory that you have to consume or for the time it would actually take to go duplicate that. And so the example we'll look at will show how we actually pull that off. So let's take a look at some of the syntax tree stuff here. We've got some things you might recognize, like we've got, you know, a type declaration, a method declaration node. And this is what's going to represent that code that's on the left, right? We have a class C. Inside class C, we've got a void method, M, and we have some comment at the end that we'll see in a bit how that's represented. And this is all inside this thing called a compilation unit. That's just a term that's from the C# spec. It basically, you think of it as one file worth of code. It's one, you know, unit that's provided to the compiler that has a set of types in it. And so in this case, we have one type. That type is one method. And then that method itself is composed of a parameter list and a block. And so, you know, this kind of makes sense, sure. But if you think in sort of compiler parlance, all those pink things there, those are non-terminals, right? And so what those non-terminals further compose into is the tokens that were actually encountered when you were parsing the file, right? And so we have things like class C, we have the braces that are around the type declaration. Inside the method declaration, we have the void type and the M name. We have the parens that are in the parameter list and so on. And so these are all the actual things that were encountered in the file that are considered semantically relevant, right? So this includes the braces, but it doesn't yet include the white space or any of the comments or things like that. Now, remember, we need to be a complete language representation. And the way we do that is through this idea of trivia. That's what we've started to call it. And trivia is stuff that isn't necessary for the semantics of the language when you're building it, but that you need for this round tripping. And we represent it by attaching it to tokens that we do care about. And you either say that it's leading trivia because it comes before, or it's trailing trivia because it comes after. And so you see all the green boxes are attached to one of the blue token boxes. And, you know, that's how we keep track of where stuff is. And remember, all these things are immutable. So if I'm ever using that brace object that has the slash C comment after it, if I reuse that later and I reattach it somewhere in my tree, I'm saying I do want that comment to come after it. So a lot of times these trivia that I'm attaching get to play along, and they get to just ride along with tokens as I manipulate tokens, which are what I often care more directly about. So you can imagine all these boxes are here just so you can trust that it's complete, but it's a bit difficult to think about on the slide, so we can eliminate that for now. And so let's imagine some transform we want to do here. Let's say we want to add int x here into the parameter list. I want to modify the parameter list, add a new parameter. So how would we go about transforming this tree to do that in this kind of immutable functional way? So if you look at the API that we exposed today in the CTP, this is the kind of code that you could write to do that. So basically, you're going to have to do this kind of, you know, replacement process. You're going to have to pick the old thing and then specify what this new thing is you want to replace it with. In this case, the old thing is the parameter list. So we go to the method. We assume we have a pointer to that. We get method.parameterList, and that represents our old list. The new list is then going to be us making some list based off of that old list, modifying as little as we can. And so we say, all right, old list.update, and now it's going to ask us for replacements for things we could want to update. And we say, okay, here, we want to update the parent token, but we're going to just use the old parent token, right? So the open parent token is the old list parent token. And the same thing for the closed parent token. So we're keeping those tokens. And again, that means we're keeping all the trivia also, so any comments that are attached will persist. But then for the parameter list, we're just kind of tossing away the old parameter list, the old parens, or not the old parens, but the old stuff that would have been in there if it happened to have a parameter list. And we're saying here, all right, syntax.separated list, make a new separated list, give it a list of one parameter, and then that parameter itself has a type, which is int. We're going to parse the type name int, and it has an identifier, which is x, which we're going to parse. And, you know, those two things together form the parameter declaration. And so we're saying, all right, well, here's this new representation. So now we've got these two things sitting side by side in memory. You know, they're sharing the parens, but the parameter stuff is different. And then what I say is, all right, I want a new root of my tree. And the new root of my tree is going to be the old root of my tree told to replace its old list with new list. Right? And so remember, I can't mutate the old root. I can't mutate any of those nodes, but I'm just going to construct a new root that represents this updated world. And so I'm hoping that afterwards, or actually just one other alternate way, if I didn't want to go through all that manual construction for parameters, I could actually just say parse parameter list and give it the whole int x, but it's mostly equivalent. So if I look at the world afterwards, this is what I'd expect, right? You know, beforehand, I go back, I had the empty parameter list. It was just had two parens there. And then afterwards, I keep the parens and squeeze in an extra parameter, right? And that parameter has a type int, and it has a name x. And so this is the transform I want to occur. But how many nodes do I really have to replace in order to pull this off? Well, you know, obviously the parameter is new, and everything under the parameter was just generated. And the parameter list itself, remember, these things have immutable lists of children. So the old parameter list had its list of children. Now there's more children, so we have to toss the old parameter list. We made a new one. And so that's new. And then the method declaration had a pointer to that particular parameter list. So now we have a different parameter list, so we're going to need a new method declaration. But we don't need a new void token. We don't need a new M, and we don't need a new block that was the body of the method. Those things didn't change, so we can reuse that. And similarly, the method declaration just changed, so we need a new type declaration, and the type declaration changed, so we need a new compilation unit. So if you think of what we've got to do, you know, we replace the parameters and everything below it, and then we sort of dig up towards the root of the tree, and we kind of swap out each of the ancestors, because those are the things whose children have changed. But you look at all the other nodes, and we can very easily just reuse those nodes. You know, when we set up what children our type declaration has, the new one, it has the same class token, it has the same C token, and so on. So really, the cost in both sort of memory and performance and rewiring things of making any change is, you know, I care about the nodes that I actually replaced, digging downwards, and then I only have to care about the ancestors going all the way up to the root of the tree. So, you know, if you look here, you notice this is probably about half the nodes that are in the tree. But let's say I had, like, some tree that was 10,000 nodes or 100,000 nodes. You know, if I was changing four nodes at the bottom and I wanted to replace them, I don't need to replace all the nodes. I replace those four, and maybe there are six ancestors up to the roots. I've replaced 10 out of 100,000 nodes. Now I have this new root object that, if you dig down, shows you this new shape of the world. And you always get a new root object from every transform that you make, but the rest of the nodes mostly stay the same. And so this is this way that we keep these snapshots, right? So you imagine I started with 100,000 objects in memory. I make this change somewhere. It's a modest change. Now I have 100,010 objects in memory. But now, depending on which root you look at, you can look downwards and dig through the tree and get a complete representation of how the world used to look and how I expect it to look. And you're only paying that incremental cost in memory. And so that's really the whole idea with the syntax trees. Right. So, yeah, the question is, how cheap is it to perform an equals operation? If you actually had to dig through the whole tree and actually compare to figure out, like, what the diffs are, that would be more expensive. Part of the plumbing of this kind of stuff and the fact that you're asking the list to update itself is that internally we can keep track of enough to make the things we want to be cheap, like those kind of diffs, cheap. So, yeah, so logically you can think of it as we toss it away, we do this kind of stuff, but internally the specifics of why methods are on the objects they're on is so you can do enough of that background processing to make it efficient. We've gone through about 5 alternate designs for how we would actually set up these trees and think, oh, let's do these red-green trees and these blue-yellow, and like people came up with these crazy ideas of how these can serve these different purposes, and you get pretty far and it kind of looks like it's working, and then you have to reevaluate. And so it does kind of make it look sort of simple, but in this case, but there's a lot of design decisions that went into actually in all of the scenarios that we care about making this really function right. So the question is about partial classes. Compilation units are a concept that comes from C#, and the file in question could actually have multiple classes in it. It wouldn't just be one class, and it could even have multiple chunks of a given partial class in a single file or a single compilation unit. So those kind of things are mostly orthogonal. It's up to the compiler, after it sees all the different components of the partial class, when it's putting this together into the symbol table, to realize what can be combined and what the semantics are, what it means to actually combine that. You can have these different elements show up in different compilation units. So that's how we can do these kind of reasonably cheap replacements. So now you think, okay, fine, we have immutable trees, they can be efficient, we believe that, but then what do we actually do to compile? And logically, you can think of a compilation as syntax trees plus references, right? Syntax trees represent your program the way you wrote it, but unless you're referencing MS-Corelib, and MS-Corelib is providing semantics for what an int is and what a long is, your program's not going to do very much. Right? And if you're referencing any third-party libraries, it's obviously very important what they're composed of as well. So the compiler takes the syntax trees you wrote, it takes the references that it saw you reference, and it's able to put those together and then actually bind your program. This is where the binder comes into play. And it's able to compile your program, so you get the symbols. You get the semantic model, which actually relies on that binding, so you can figure out what type things are, what it means to be a certain type. Is this type implicitly convertible to that type? You can get the flow analysis. You can say, well, given what we know about this type, is it actually a struct that's completely initialized at this point? Did we set all the right members for it to be initialized? Things like that. All the way down to actually, emitting a binary out the other end. You know, we have all the data. We figure out enough that we can, emit something that's actually going to run and execute and perform what you wanted it to do. So with that in mind, let's actually dig into code now and explore what it means to actually use these APIs. So I'm going to go here to Roslyn demo, and I'm going to use snippets to paste code in, so you don't have to watch me write a whole bunch of code, but we can talk to what it is that we're pasting in. So I'm going to start off here with sort of just the simplest thing using the Roslyn APIs. And, you can see just first off, what I'm referencing here, I'm referencing Roslyn.compilers. This is that bottom tier, the compiler API that's language specific. And then the services API, this is that kind of workspace level where we're trying to unify things again. But for this demo, we're mostly going to just start off using the compiler APIs. And what I'm bringing in here is I'm saying, all right, go to the syntax tree type. Remember, this is that core type on the bottom layer. And tell, hey, syntax tree, parse this compilation unit. And I'm giving it a string that represents the whole file, the whole compilation unit. And it's a class C that's got a long X field in it. All right, so I'm parsing it. And then what do I get back? What I get back is a Roslyn syntax tree, specifically a C-sharp syntax tree. Okay, so I've got that. Now I can start to analyze this. In one line, I've parsed this, and I can now dig into the object model and see what's going on. So I can say, all right, well, let's say we want to identify this zero. We really want to hone in on the zero and get some more data about what's going on there. So if I think about how I dig into this, I could say, all right, we'll take the tree, start at the root, and now this kind of looks like linked to XML in a way. It's kind of fluent tree walking API we have. So I'm saying, go to the descendant nodes. This would get all of them, but just take the ones that are of type field declaration syntax. Dig into that, and then take the first such field declaration syntax. We know there's only one, so we're just going to take here long x equals 0. All right, we've got that. And now we're going to get the initializer. So we say, all right, given that we have the field, go to the field, take its declaration, right? You know, the fact that, okay, the field is this whole thing, but here's one declaration, x equals 0, or sorry, just the set of declarations, and take the variables that are involved, right? So you could say, all right, long x equals 0, comma y equals 1, comma z equals 2. So you could have more than one variable that's involved here. But just take the whole set of them, take the first one. Again, we know there's only one because it's a demo. And then say dot initializer, right? So the initializer is actually going to be this expression here, the sort of equals expression that initializes the object or the x value here. And then within that initializer, we're going to go then say get its values. So this is actually finally grabbing the zero node. And if I set a breakpoint here and I run, just so we can take a look, we can see what I get here from var is going to be this expression syntax node. And so, you know, and if I look, it's specifically a literal expression syntax node. It happens to be this numeric literal expression, and the value it represents is 0. Now, one of these things I can do, because I have the Roslyn CTP installed, I've gone ahead and installed the Roslyn syntax visualizer. So the syntax visualizer is a sample that comes with the Roslyn CTP. You can install it. It plugs in as a visualizer into VS, and it really kind of helps you get a feel for the trees if you're really learning this for the first time. And I'm just going to click this here. And it loads up, and we see that in yellow, this kind of numeric literal expression, this is the thing we were looking at, but we can see the rest of the tree around it, right? We can see that here's the declarator, right? And we can select over here, that's a whole x equals 0, and then inside that was this equals value clause, that was that initializer, inside which was the value, which was this, right? And if you keep digging up, you get to the field declaration, which is this whole thing, you know, and then there's all the different components of it, the statements, the expressions within that, and so on. And so this is that syntax tree that, you know, we can get this purely just by parsing. We don't need to know what long means. We just know it's a type. But then we can continue on there. So, all right, we have this now. What else can we do? Well, that's about as far as we can get just by looking at the tree. To get any further into the analysis we want to do, we actually have to know about references. We have to know what long is, we have to know what int is, how these things are convertible to each other. And so the way we do this is we create a compilation. That way we can go ahead and do semantic binding. And I'm saying here, go ahead, you know, var comp, create a compilation, give it an awesome name. Add a reference, in this case, to MSCoreLib, right? You know, this is sort of just a little trick we're using here to get a reference to MSCoreLib. Take, you know, type of int, get its location, pass that in. That'll reference MSCoreLib. And then we're adding in the syntax trees we have. Remember, a compilation is syntax trees plus references. So we've added that together, and now we have this compilation we can act against. And so what do I want to do? Well, I want to go get some binding data. I want to get logic from that blue box that's going to tell me more detailed stuff about the language. And the way you do that is you say, all right, well, you ask the compilation to give you back its semantic model. This is what it thinks about when it's doing binding. And then once you have that model, you can start to ask for this detailed semantic info about any given node in the tree. So we have our little zero node, and we're going to ask for semantic info about that particular expression. And, you know, once you have this object, you can do all sorts of fun stuff. So we look at what's on info here. Info has things like, given things if you know if it didn't resolve but it could have resolved, you know, what were the other things this might have bound to? If you stay down here, is it a compile time constant? Does this represent a compile time constant in C sharp? You know, according to the C sharp specific language rules. Get me the symbol that's actually associated with this. Get me the type that's associated with this. And you see the things that we care about here, right? I care, is this an implicit conversion? I'm caring specifically what's the type of that zero, but then I'm also caring what's the converted type of that zero. You know, something has an implicit or an intrinsic type. You know, zero is an int literal. All integer literals, unless otherwise specified, are considered integer or int literals in C sharp, but it's used in a long context. It's used as an initializer for a long value, and so therefore it's going to be implicitly converted over to long. So these two types, in this case, are going to be different as far as the language is concerned. So now that we have this, let's run it and see what it says. And we see that, indeed, the implicit conversion we had was specifically an implicit numeric conversion. We started with a real type of int for that that literal value that we had, but then its converted type was long based on the place where it was put in the tree, where it was applied. And so we can actually dig to and get that information. Now, you know, think, we did, you know, some a little bit of work here. We, you know, set up this object, we kind of dug through it, but all the stuff we did here was sort of just directly expressing our intent. I want to dig to there, I want to find out this. We didn't have to code in any of the rules and remember that C-sharp treats longs this way and all that stuff. We're actually discovering that by making these queries. We're asking the language to tell us what it thinks should happen based on the binding rules that it understands. And we get to just provide our extra analysis, whatever added value we're going to provide. So, you know, go back to the slides for a sec. You know, if we take a look, that was really the compiler APIs, right? That's the kind of stuff you do with the low-level syntax nodes. You can go ask for details about the tree. Once you have the tree, you can provide references and ask for this kind of analysis, this binding-level semantic analysis about the nodes. But where it really starts to get interesting is as you start to bubble up to these higher tiers in the API. So as we think about that second tier, remember that tier where things start to unify across C-sharp and VB, we think of the workspace API, and this is this concept of trading in compilation units for this general notion of documents. Yep. Can semantic models be what? I guess what specifically would you mean? Like, what would it mean to compare to semantic models? Okay, so you're asking, can you compare two different expressions and look at their semantic models and see if those expressions would compile? Mm-hmm. So I guess you could go to the end, and to whatever extent you would define the same, you could see if, let's say, like emitting IL would give you the same thing, or if you would have a type that examining it would give you the same shape. The notion of sort of identity and equality is sort of squishy to define there. Like, we have a very strong notion of identity because we care about all these random things like white space and stuff. We don't consider tokens identical unless they have that because we don't want to unify them. So sort of for whatever purpose you would need the answer to that question, you could define your own equality comparison. You have all the info you need in the nodes to figure that out, but we don't try to provide that notion to you just because it's so specific to what you're trying to do. So in this case, now, you know, we're starting to combine this, and you notice that instead at the bottom tier here, we have documents. And documents are sort of the core of this sort of document project solution hierarchy. You can kind of think of the stuff you see in Solution Explorer, but it's really intended to be more broad than that, because you could imagine, you know, not just for something you'd think about with MS Build, but also for something in the REPL. As you're starting to define types, as you're referencing other environments, you want to pull these things together maybe in a more virtual way. You think of some of the build scenarios for things like, you know, XAML, where you kind of have to jump through a lot of hoops now to make fake files and plumb them through. A lot of this is sort of just calling out for somebody to say, here's a logical flow of how my compilation works, and you can flow that kind of stuff together. And the idea is that these projects can be different languages, right? There's certain things they share in common, the ability to expose metadata, to have symbols that are shared across the different projects. And only, you know, within those projects, as you're defining semantics, would the specifics of C-sharp and VB actually matter. And so I go ahead, I combine the documents up into projects into solutions. And this is still following that same pattern of immutability. You know, all the way through the syntax nodes that are in there, up to the document, up through to the solution, they're still immutable, right? So the tiniest change I make, if I let it bubble all the way up, is going to impact and go up to my root and make me a new solution that represents the new state of the world. But again, that's very cheap, just because it's like a handful of extra ancestor nodes that I have to go swap out. And, you know, even when I'm first loading the solution, it's not just about mutating it. Even, let's say, I load a solution that has 1,000 projects in it, I don't want to have to sit there and crunch on it and load all sorts of stuff into memory just to get going. I might only care about one of the projects, and it could be a leaf node project. And so at that point, I'm able to say, well, go here, get me this project's document, get me its syntax tree. And the moment I care about the syntax tree, it's lazily loaded at that point. You know, and only if I ask for semantic information about that document will the document go up and say, oh, well, to get semantic information, I need to go up to my project to get its compilation information. I need to use the references that I know this project has to actually get a compilation and start doing semantic analysis. So we do these things only as needed, and it allows us to have the policy to figure out how we cache stuff and when do we throw away and what do we actually dig back through to manage memory and to manage your efficiency properly. And so, you know, so this is all well and good. We have our immutability going up to the solution level. But, you know, if you think about it, at its core, an editor that somebody's typing in, by its nature, has mutable state. There is only one current state of the editor, one true state of the solution if you're in an IDE at one point. And at some point, that has to meet all of these snapshots that are being created. So you can sort of think of the workspace, in a way, as the mutable analog to the solution. It kind of represents the entire project or the entire state of the world the way that the solution does. But it does so sort of from that mutable perspective. It sort of tracks the current state of things from the way that a host environment would actually want to track it. And, you know, when you actually want solution changes to bubble into the workspace and vice versa, there's this interesting way that they interact. So you imagine that the workspace says, hey, somebody typed some characters into this part of this document. So it's going to bubble that change down to the solution and sort of permeate that through to the documents that are affected. And that's going to come back up and say, okay, well, here's a new solution root node that's been swapped out the way we saw before when we were adding a parameter list. And what that's going to result in is the tiniest changes or the biggest changes are going to keep iterating this solution. We're going to get a new solution 2, solution 3, solution 4. And these might still be like pending changes. Imagine somebody's considering a refactoring and the compiler is figuring out all the different things you would want to do, that you might want to do, and actually showing this potential future to the user. And at some point, the user says, yes, this is a refactoring that I want. I see sort of the future state of the solution, and I like it better than the old state of the solution, so I want to commit that. And at that point, you can apply those changes that were accumulated back to the workspace, and that actually then commits that, and the workspace is now updated and says, okay, solution N is now my current solution. And the old solutions are just still in memory if they're referenced by somebody in case this kind of ongoing analysis was in flight at the time against one of those snapshots. And so this is this way in which you keep the workspace as sort of the mutable source of truth, but it's doing that by keeping track of which snapshot, which solution currently represents what it considers the truth. And everybody's still using those shared syntax tree nodes in order to do that. And so the idea is really that this is coming from a host environment, coming from something like VS, which is going to send key presses down, or so on. So let's explore what we can do with the Workspace API. I'm going to go back. I'm going to delete all of this. And I'm going to go back in here and put in, you know, loading the solution here. And what you see here is I'm loading a solution just directly by saying load this SLN file. And if we look at what this solution is, the vertical resolution here is not helping, but you can see that it's basically three projects. The second one of which is actually referring out to the other two, right? So you can see that there is a public class A here that's defining some protected const, public class C in project 3 that's defining some public const, and then project 2 has type B, which, you know, derives from A, so it can get to the protected thing, and it also references C. If we look over here, class 2 is referencing the other two, so has access to that. has access to that stuff. All right, so this is the state of the world, right? And it's a pretty simple project when we look at it here. But, you know, to actually reason about all of these different relations and how that affects things and the fact that this is protected and so therefore it matters that I derive from it for that to be visible, you know, it starts to become non-trivial if we had to think about all those rules ourselves. So what do we get to write now? Let's say that we actually want to go in, and just like we analyzed the zero before, let's say we want to dig into this project and analyze this initializer expression. It's a little more complex now, and thinking about it is more than thinking about a literal zero. We have to think about relationships between projects. So I'm going to go here and say, all right, that's the workspace I'm loading. And, you know, we can just test that this is working. I'm going to put in some simple code here that iterates through the workspace. Now remember, the workspace is mutable, so it has a current solution. It actually has an opinion about which solution is current. And then I can dig through that solution's projects and go into the project's display names and the documents that compose it and just output them to the console. And so if I run it, you see that I'm successfully loading the solution and I'm outputting all the projects in there. So it looks like we're good to go. So I'm going to delete this now. And in its place, let's actually just go find those documents. So let's say here, all right, this is just some, you know, obviously demo code here that goes into the workspace and says, get the solution, get the projects, find the one called class library 2, and in that project, find the document called b.cs. So we're just finding a way to arbitrarily grab b.cs. But, you know, once we have b.cs, we have this Roslyn document, this I document that's general across languages, and, well, look what I can do. I can now go directly to the document and pull back a syntax tree. Remember, you know, before I had a parse to get a syntax tree, but the document knows what source code it represents, and so I can just ask it for the syntax tree. And it may have it cached. So I'm actually letting now the Workspace API deal with all the policy of, hey, when do I cache it? When do I throw things away? Is this going to be garbage collected? I just ask it to get me a syntax tree, and it does the rest. And so, all right, fine. I now have the syntax tree. It's still a general tree. I go and I say, go to the descendant nodes, dig down, find me a field declaration syntax like I was doing before, and then dig all the way through it and get down to its value, right? This is the same kind of stuff I was writing before. Those two lines are basically equivalent. But I'm starting from a syntax tree I got by loading a solution rather than just parsing some arbitrary source code. It's all the same under the covers. And so now that I'm here, I can do, again, exactly the same thing I did before. I'm getting the semantic model, I'm digging through, getting info for that one expression, and I'm analyzing it in the same ways. The one extra little trick is that up to this point, I was actually operating against that I thing. Right? So you see here I have, actually in this case I have expression syntax. But up to some point here, like the document itself, when I get the semantic model, it's an I document, right? And when I get a semantic model, I'm going to get an I semantic model. I'm operating at this workspace layer, and I'm doing it in this somewhat general way. And so in this case, I happen to know it's C#, and I'm going to be asking some C#-specific questions about the implicit conversions. And so I'm going to cast this down to the C# semantic info to do that. But if I happen to only care about things that were common across languages, I wouldn't have to. And so I do this, and I run it. And when I run it, well, it's going to run, and it's going to output the same thing it outputted before. So it doesn't look too exciting, except when you think about what it's doing. Right before, to figure that out, we just kind of looked at some source code and said, well, zero is an int, and that's a long, and so therefore it's an int to long conversion, and that's numeric, right? But now what we're doing is we're saying, well, we only know, how do we even know that this is int and long, right? If we remember, if we go here and run to that point and actually take a look at expression, if we dig through to this again, remember the expression in question is c.x plus a.z. If we just have a parse tree, it's not very obvious that c.x plus a.z is going to be of type integer. And you can't even look at this entire project and know that c.x plus a.z is an integer. You have to pull in these other projects. You have to do the binding to understand type information. You need to understand the relationship between projects. The fact that this isn't an error, the fact that this type is even allowed to access the value of a.z because b happens to derive from a. Right? And so all of these things are actually occurring under the covers, and we just get the benefit of being able to ask a simple question. What is the, you know, effective type of this expression here? And we can go make that query because the compiler logic is being exposed to us and understands all these relationships. So the question is, what happens if one of those is F# or managed C++? The reason we can pull these in today as projects in the sort of rich project way is because under the covers, those do actually support Roslyn. If you were targeting an F# project and F# didn't support Roslyn, you would basically be referencing it as an opaque reference in the same way that you reference MS Corelib and other BCL assemblies. So you wouldn't actually be able to pull it in that way. You'd have to have some other process that's compiling it and just giving you a DLL, and that would just be an input to the Roslyn area. And there's a lot of things today in the IDE. Like when you see a solution in VS today kind of looks like a nice abstraction, has projects of all different languages. But a lot of the sort of niceness we're talking about here with VB and C# working together and smoothly communicating across those boundaries, that doesn't happen today, even within our native model. There's a lot of places where if I have a C# thing talking to a VB thing, it looks like it's a nice project-to-project reference, but it's treated internally as this file reference, as if you just made a DLL and you're poking at it. And the one place you can recognize that is when you do or don't get live IntelliSense. Like, if you're talking to two C# projects or two VB and you change the code, you don't even have to build. The other code knows about it. But when you're talking across these boundaries, there's many cases where suddenly I don't get anything until I build, and the other project system is only, or the other IDE language service is only actually going and looking at the binary output, and they're communicating indirectly like that. So this is going a long way towards sort of unifying C# and VB, and if this model was considered opened up, right, and some other language played along, you could imagine that too. But it would have to be a language that plays along. Anything else would just be an opaque reference that comes in from the side. So, right, so I was basically here. I was able to do the same thing, do it against a much more complex system that I have to analyze, but come to the same kind of conclusion. So that's that second tier, right? And, you know, this is fun and it's interesting if you're, you know, kind of a language geek and you can really enjoy the fact that we're doing this stuff and being able to have this stuff go across these the languages and do this kind of analysis. But really where the rubber hits the road and it actually provides value is when we can provide IDE services on top of this that actually make you more productive and let you do this complex analysis. And so that's when we get to this third tier, this tier where we're at the editor services layer. And really sort of the shiniest part of the editor services layer is the one we saw at the beginning, this idea of having code actions, things you can expose to the user that they can do to sort of affect these tree transforms without typing all this stuff themselves. And so if you look at this, well, the core of code actions is the idea of a code action, and it's a representation of some code change, some tree transform that's going to occur within our immutable structures, right? And, you know, it represents an edit, so sort of the before and after state of an edit. But it also, by doing that, allows for this kind of previewing of the edit. Because we have the snapshot before and after, we can do this kind of intelligent diffing. We can figure out what is actually changed and what to show to the user. And these actions surface in one of two ways, right? So you can surface as a code issue. This is the kind of thing traditionally you think of as compiler errors, warnings, style cop, FX cop, those kind of things where you're going to maybe want to squiggle something in the code or at least tell the user in the error list that something is wrong. And then, you know, sure, you can navigate to it and at least give that description, but maybe you actually want to provide a solution. If you know what's wrong and you know what you would do to actually go fix it, why not offer that as a solution and let the user choose an action that actually resolves the issue for them? And so an issue can optionally go ahead and provide those kind of code actions. And so the other thing you can do is a code refactoring. So you remember when we had like 4.0, and, you know, we selected that at the beginning, and then we said, hey, find me all the 4.0s. That was an optional thing that I could do. I selected 4.0 and this refactoring said, hey, I'm relevant now. So that was a contextually available refactoring. It was something I could do to my code because of where my cursor happened to be, what I happened to have selected. And so it operates on the current selection, and the only point of it is to provide a code action, so it's got to have at least one. But this is this thing that can just generally provide us insight into wherever my code is and give me things that I could do to transform my code. So let's see how we'd actually go about writing one of these quick fixes and then see how we can make it even cooler by making it active so it can fix your code for you. So I'm going to go here. I'm actually going to ignore this oops, I don't want to do that. I'm going to stop this first so I can make a new project. And I'm going to make a new project specifically of a Roslyn type. You see here, I have the Roslyn CTP installed. What it does is it adds this new top-level node within the Visual C# tree here. So I can say, all right, code issue. And I'm just going to call this my first quick fix. And so we're going to build this now. It's going to make me this project. And you see it's pulling in the same kind of namespace as I saw before, the first and second tiers. But if I look at the references, we see that I'm also getting these Visual Studio assemblies in here. So we're starting to get, you know, above the sort of totally general purpose Roslyn APIs that you could imagine using for all different command line tools and other kind of things, even separate from an IDE. And we're getting closer to those things that are really well tied, not even just to an IDE, but specifically to Visual Studio. And so specifically here, I'm making an I code issue provider. So this is something that's going to be able to surface code issues into the IDE by doing analysis of nodes that it's given. And so we see, all right, it's a C# code issue provider, pretty simple. You see that the bulk of the logic is all here inside this getIssues method. And so basically, this is implementing the visitor pattern. We have a tree, so visitor pattern is pretty convenient. And we're going to be called, and they're going to call getIssues on us and say, hey, here's a node. You tell me whether this node represents an issue. And do whatever analysis you have to do. You have the rich functionality, all the Roslyn stuff you could want to pull off. But tell us if there's an issue, and if so, give the details. Basically what's going on here, there's a sort of default thing that comes here in the code issue provider template, and it's kind of a silly code issue provider. It goes and says, all right, for that given node that you told us, go get the child nodes and tokens. It does a link query here to say, all right, once we have those, take just the ones that are tokens, not nodes, and then for each of them, convert it to be a token. So we actually have a list of tokens. And then for each of those tokens, get the text from the token, just the raw text that was represented in the editor or in the source file for that, and then see if it contains the letter A. And if it does, issue the very serious compiler warning that that token happens to contain the letter A. And if we run this now you notice I'm in Visual Studio, but when I ran this, what it ran was another version of Visual Studio. Right? That outer version I was in, it was just plain vanilla VS. Happens to reference some Roslyn APIs, but that's it. What I'm loading now is that version of Visual Studio that has the extension manager built in, that has the Roslyn services built in into the extensions, into the extension system. And not only that, it has also as an extension the quick fix that I'm working on. So my project is also installed as an extension when I hit Control F5. So I'm going to go here and say, all right, well, I see that that's loaded. I'm going to load quick fix demo code. It's going to be some project we operate over. And so this loads up. And I see, all right, it's loading, and then bam. So here's all my new warnings that static contains letter A and program contains letter A. I don't know. I guess we could imagine a code action here that just removes all the A's. That would probably make your code worse. So we're not going to pursue this one in particular. We can start from this template and actually produce something reasonably useful. So just thinking of something we could do, what about something that goes and identifies for a given field, could this field have actually been a const field? Not a field, sorry, a local. Could this local have actually been a const local? And, there's different rules that relate to the language that determine that. Like, what do const locals have to do? Well, they have to be composed of other constants, like literals or, another const local or const field or something. And, they also themselves, whenever they're used within that method, they have to not be changed. Because if something's changed, it can't be const. But if it's satisfying those kind of general rules, then I should be able to make it a const local. And so this is something you kind of imagine is reasonable to implement because I have access to all this data. And so let's see what I can do about that. So I'm going to open up here these snippets. And I'm going to see here. So basically I have this up here that says, okay, this is a C# quick fix. But I can go and actually be more specific and say that this is a quick fix that specifically applies to local declaration syntax, right? The only thing I'm going to squiggle is some local declaration that probably should be a const local declaration. So I don't need this to be passing me every single node in the tree. I only want it to give me local declarations, and I'm going to go figure out if it should be changed. Okay, so we got that. Now that I've done that, I can guarantee that all the nodes that are going to be flowing in through this getIssues method are going to be local declarations. And so I'm just going to go here and say, all right, var local declaration, cast it. I can assume that's going to work out. And then for this next step, what do I have? All I have right now is the syntax tree. So the only kind of tests I can perform are syntactic tests that operate only on the tree. But it turns out, there's a lot of things I can kick out as being not valid for my consideration just based on the syntax tree. Well, so first of all, the easiest one, if the declaration's modifiers already include the const keyword, then there's not much left for us to do. So we can bail out and we return null. There's no issue to be had with this node. So that's the first check there. Then we say, all right, well, we know we're going to at some point need this containing block. We're going to need the scope in which the declaration exists because we need to go look through the rest of it to see if anybody wrote to the local in that scope. So we need to obtain the containing block. Now remember that sometimes these error nodes exist or things will exist in a place where the compiler guesses what something is. So, it's somewhat possible you could have a local declaration that somehow is not inside a method if the user has error code or they've been pasting between different parts of their program. So we just double check that we actually have this containing block. If we don't, it's nothing for us to do. So now that we've got a hold of the containing block, we say, all right, well, it's no use to make something const if it wasn't actually initialized by the local declaration. If I just say, int x, I can't make that const int x until I give it a value. So I can only make something const if it's like int x equals 0. So the thing we then check is if any of the variables that are initialized by this initializer expression don't have an initializer, don't have an actual initializer there, then we just bail out because we can't make that declaration constant. So these are the three checks we can do just based on the shape of the parse tree. So good, we did that. Now we move on and we start doing more advanced tests. We do tests based on the semantic model. So besides the node, we're also given the document. And this document is our key to dig through and get access to binding, know what references are going to be in scope at this point when we're processing this this particular node. And so, all right, now we have a semantic model. Now we can start answering more interesting questions. One of them being, hey, is all of that stuff, we said, hey, everything has an initializer. We can just tell if an initializer exists. That's what the parse tree tells us. But are we initializing it with things that are constant? Right? Is the type of the thing being initialized good enough? Is it an int? Right, and not only is it an int, is it something that, you know, an int that's coming from a literal, or is an int that's coming from another constant? You know, if it's an int that comes from a method call, that's not going to help us either. And so this goes through and it says, all right, well, for all the declarations variables, select out each one of those initializer values, right? It could be either equals zero or it could be equals, you know, c.x plus a.z. Select those expressions. And for each of them, get their semantic info. Now we've got i is coming in here, that's the initializer. We get info, which is the info. And we're going to say, all right, well, is compile time constant? This is a helper that isemanticinfo defines. You know, C-sharp and VB are each required to say, for a given node, is this yes or no a compile time constant? And it's useful for things like this when we want to figure out the answer to these questions. So I can say, all right, well, for this particular expression, based on everything you know about the language and the things you know about the types of these particular expressions, could I treat this as a compile time constant? And if the answer is, you know, no, if it's not true for any of them, then we bail out, right? If any of those x equals 2, y equals whatever things are not going to be constant, we can't make the whole expression constant. All right, so we did that test. We're, you know, gradually validating that this thing is actually okay to be made const. So now we have sort of the last big test here, and it looks like a lot of code, but it kind of makes sense when you break it down. So we checked that the declaration itself is fine. But now we have to check that the code after the declaration is not going to mess that up, right? Sure, maybe we initialize it to zero, and that's const. But if later on I say equals 3, I've modified it. And that means I can't have made the local declaration const anymore. And so what I'm going to do is first I'm setting up the bounds in which I might care to see if this thing is written to. And so I start basically at the end of the local declaration. So someone says, you know, int x equals 7. Well, I'm going to stop at the end past the 7, and I'm going to search beyond that, or past the semicolon afterwards. And then I'm going to search from there to the end of that containing block that I figured out. I went up to the ancestor node, found that block that it was within, and I'm going to go from here to there. And so that's the only code within which somebody could either assign to this variable or do more advanced things. Maybe they pass it as a ref to some method, right? That's another thing that would consider writing to it, right? So I start to think of all these ways in which it could be written to, and you know, maybe I'd have to imagine I have to check all that. Well, luckily, data flow is one of these things you really have to think about often for many kind of refactorings and language features and IDE surface area. And so what we do is we actually provide on the semantic model a direct way that you can get back an analysis of the data flow through a particular region of code. And so you say, all right, well, give me the analysis bounds. It's going to give back the data flow. And we get back this this object of type I region data flow analysis. And now we can go and ask a really interesting question. We can say, all right, for every one of the variables, select not the initializer, don't select the equals zero, select the x or the y, whatever variable name was being declared. And then, for this data flow analysis, for that region we have, take the collection of things that we know are written to inside that region and see if x is one of them or see if y is one of them. You know, and if we look in that collection, we say, well, y is written to, and we're trying to make y const, that's not going to work. So then we bail out. So we see if any of the variables we're trying to do are written to, we bail. If that's not true, we've made it past the final test, and we can finally put in this code action here, or this code issue here. So now I go ahead, I return the code issue. I say it's a warning. I give it the span of the declaration, the whole thing, and I say it can be made constant. And so now if I run this, I'm here, I'm loading the new version of my extension. I go into quick fix demo code. And you see that as this loads, I now get two squiggles, one on each of these ints because they're each initialized with a literal, that could be constant. And you see, though, it's actually reacting nicely as I'm typing. I type const, I hit space, and then, you know, suddenly, well, if it wasn't glitching there for a sec, suddenly it actually manages to come back and realize that that wasn't const. And actually, wait, I made I and j const, and now because they're both const, suddenly k could actually be const, right? Now, you know, you might think, oh man, I'm going to have to maintain all these relationships and think, wait, if this is doing that, but by you just declaratively saying, all right, I tell you what's going on for this type of node, so you tell me when I might have to care about that node, you go and say, hey, does this node have an issue or not? The Roslyn infrastructure is going to just ask you those questions. You're responsible for saying yes or no, and it's responsible for knowing that it should come down here and ask you about this node again, because your answer to the question might have changed. And so you get to write this in this very compact, easy way that actually directly represents the question and the thing you want to do, and don't have to think about race conditions in the IDE. You don't have to think about how you actually manage all this complexity that we have to manage today. And, you know, one other fun kind of thing here, if we go to a different workspace, like this is sort of a project workspace, but think of the interactive prompt, right? This is something that's offered by Roslyn. This is this REPL that we're trying to enable by having this kind of rich interaction. If you haven't seen this before, what Dustin on the Roslyn team likes to say is it's the largest working set calculator that you'll ever encounter. But besides 1 plus 1, we can obviously do more interesting things and set up methods, right? Something you can't do in the immediate window today. And I can go back up here, and if I go back to my code, let's say I take off the const and I copy this, and I go back down here to the interactive window. If I paste this in here, now, even in the interactive window, I'm getting these kind of warnings. And these are specifically the code issues that I said there. And I can continue to make these live changes, and these live changes are going to interact in the same way that I saw before. So I'm providing this functionality once, and it surfaces anywhere that I have a workspace that might care about C-sharp code. It might have local declaration syntax nodes. So let's actually just quickly go back then and say, all right, we have our code issue. What can we do to make this active? What can we do to make it actionable so you could go ahead and fix it? So, you know, the way you do this is you go and you add to your code issue, and you make, in addition to that, a code action object. So I'm going to go here and say, add a new class. This is going to be code action. Not a very creative name. And first of all, I'm just going to go up here and add the kind of usings that I need. And then within here, I'm going to, you know, just delete this and add a new base that I'm going to start with that implements the Roslyn iCode action type. You can imagine what that does. And, you know, it has all the core stuff I care about, you know, description. I'm providing a description. It has an icon, right, that I could overload and, you know, put in there for some particular action I want to do. I'm not going to put one in for now. And it has this getEdit method, right? And you can think of this in the same way as getIssues. At the point that my action is going to be active, we know that there is an issue, and I'm going to provide the particular edit in question, the tree transform, that's going to actually affect this. So I'm going to say here, all right, just one thing I have to do first. I have to actually get some data from the issue into the action. And the place where I actually need the action ultimately is here when I'm creating the code issue. So I'm just going to say here, new code action. And I haven't defined a constructor yet, but I'm going to use generate from usage to cheat a little bit here. I'm going to say, all right, new code action. I know I'm going to need the local declaration. I know I'm going to need the document. And it turns out I also need this edit factory thing. When you construct a code issue, you get passed into the constructor an edit factory that you stash and use to make code actions later. So we're going to pass that through. And so this constructor doesn't exist, but I can use generate from usage to actually make the constructor. And then when I dig in here, I now have, you know, some nice private variables to hold on to this stuff. So that's very convenient, especially for demos. And so now I'm going to go here. I've got this stuff passed in. It's all here where it belongs, and I can go and implement this. And so now, remember, there's nothing left to figure out. I know that there's an issue here. I just have to go about, you know, constructing this action. And, you know, there's a little bit of tricky stuff going on here, but it kind of makes sense, right? Remember that I have to care about the trivia. I'm now trying to make an action. This has to be a transform on the tree that the users are going to trust. And so I can't be messing with comments they have, with white space that they have. And so what I'm trying to do here is inject the const token at the beginning of their line. And so that whatever that first token happens to be now, I need to get that leading trivia that was before it. Maybe it's a sort of slash star kind of comment that's there at the beginning. I want to capture that and reattach it to the beginning of my const node. I'm kind of squeezing my const node in there between the first token and its trivia. And so the way I do that is, again, the stuff is immutable, so I take the first token, I get it like that, I get that token's leading trivia, and then I make myself a new local declaration that has that first token replaced with one that has empty trivia. It's replaced with one whose leading trivia is set to this empty trivia list, right? So I basically snipped off the trivia from the first token. And then I make myself a const token that I'm planning to glue to the beginning, and I say that const token is, well, it's the const keyword, obviously, but the trivia before it is that leading trivia that I snipped off. So I snipped it off, attached it to my const token, and, you know, removed it from the original node where it was. So, you know, you can see how you kind of glue the stuff in there. Now, basically, you know, this is, again, just to be pretty complete, I'm making a new modifier list. My modifier list, really, there's only one valid modifier for locals, which is const. But again, you need to be able to deal with error code. Maybe the user pasted some like read-only declaration into their method. It's got the read-only modifier. It's not valid, but making something const, I shouldn't delete these invalid modifiers they have. I should leave them there so the user can rationalize why they left it there. Maybe they were leaving it there as a note that they still had to go through and process something. So let's not mess with that. We'll take whatever modifiers are there and make a new modifier list that can catch const onto the beginning. We then go here and make our new replacement local. You know, and again, this is taking the trimmed local declaration, the one that has the stuff snipped off, changes with this new modifier list, that's why it's going to have const, and then uses the same stuff. It uses the same declaration, the same semicolon token, right? We're using the same versions of these things. We're not even using a new semicolon, because that semicolon could have a comment after it. So by reusing those tokens, we're able to keep all that stuff intact without a special effort for us. I do one more thing here, which is just to apply formatting. This is just a little annotation I can apply that says, hey, by the way, Roslyn, when you get up there, go ahead and trigger formatting so that if anything, that any of these changes would have thrown off the formatting of the line, go reformat it for us. And it lets the language provide input there and what that means. And that's it. I've now got my node, right? The node I want to replace, so I just do my replacement. I say, get the syntax tree we've got now, go to the root, replace the original local declaration with this formatted one. It kept going through all these new and formatting, all this stuff. I got to the final one, and I made all these immutable nodes along the way. I finally got to the one I want, and I replace the old one with a new one and get a new root. And now that I have this root, I go ahead and construct an edit from that root. And I say, all right, well, make me, with the edit factory, make me a tree transform edit based on this solution, this original tree, and this new root that I created. This is what I want the world to look like after the edit. And that should be it. I run this now. I go to my quick fix demo code again. And so we should see exactly the same thing we saw before, except that now you see we have a smart tag here. And if I go to the smart tag, we see make constant. And not only do we see make constant, you really should take a look at this one. Not only do we see make constant, we also see a preview of what the world will look like after we make it constant, right? So it says, sure, that's const in I, and the other thing still has a squiggle. That's fine. So we get out of here. I'm going to actually go make that happen. But now with the next one, if I do this, well, if I make this constant, we see that in that future world where I make it constant, well, then the next thing is going to have my squiggle. So I have the current state of the universe, and my snapshot in the future is no better or worse than my current snapshot. They're both just immutable states of the world that could exist. And so in the future snapshot, it's just running my same thing again against that tree. My analysis engine doesn't know any better about what's current or not current. It just goes and looks at it and says, yep, int k equals I plus j. That's going to need to have a squiggle on it. And so I know that and then can manifest that by actually saying, sure, make constant. I bring that to be the new reality. And, you know, the most fun of all is if, you know, who wants to bet whether this is actually going to work in the interactive window? If I go here and say void m, I take this. I'm going to just go back here, take the original code again, go back to the C-sharp interactive window, paste this into my method up here. I'm getting all this. I can execute my code actions in here. And when I go to this code action, I get exactly the same thing. I'm able to get this predictive power of what the future world is going to look like inside my REPL, because, again, it's the same kind of workspace as my solution, and all of these snapshots are morally equivalent. I can analyze all of them equally well. And so I hope you guys have really gotten a chance with this. I mean, that's really cool. That the fact that I can have this kind of sort of multiverse of possibilities in the world, let users choose between them, is really where that power of having an immutable model comes into the fore, right? There's plenty of other environments today where you can do these kind of refactorings, these kind of analyses, but we think taking a big bet on doing things in this immutable way is going to let us do all sorts of really awesome language features, or language IDE services, like those kind of live preview refactorings. And not only do them ourselves, but give you guys a super simple model where you can plug in just the refactoring or just the issue and have it surface all the way through the IDE without you having to think of the fact that a REPL even exists. That's just a natural offshoot of you targeting this one specific code-focused thing that you want to do. So definitely, if this stuff is intriguing to you guys, go out there and try it. The Roslyn CTP is available. You can go to msdn.microsoft.com/Roslyn, download it, try it out. All this stuff is super early. So, I mean, the languages aren't even fully implemented yet. The APIs are in heavy flux, right? So this is the time to try it out. Tell us what's easy. Tell us what's hard. Go in the forums and talk about it, because we're actively reshaping these APIs based on all the feedback we're getting. And then basically just tell us what you want to get accomplished. What kind of things do you want to add to the IDE? And let's make sure we have the right extensibility points to enable all that. And most important, as you get all this feedback, share it on the forum, or you can send mail to me, alexturn@microsoft.com, and I'll make sure it gets forwarded and gets on to the right place. And with that, that's it. Thanks.